I thought you were coming by at 12.
I'm opening this meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Subcommittee on Human Services today is March 4th. We're having a public hearing and work session followed by another public hearing. So I'm opening the public hearing on House Bill 2395 relating to state medical assistance program funding. Ms. Ames.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, House Bill 2395A is coming to you from the House Committee on Health Care. It extends the hospital assessment for 4 years from September 2015 to September 2019. The monies related to 1 percentage point of the assessment will be split with 1/2 distributed to hospitals based on their achievement of performance metrics, and the other 1/2 distributed to CCOs based on recommendations from the Metrics and Scoring Committee. The bill also repeals the sunset of statutes related to mandatory reimbursement by CCOs to non-contracting hospitals, commonly called the PAR-non-PAR rate. The fiscal for the bill for the 15-17 biennium is $3.3 billion total funds. This includes $880 million of hospital assessments and $2.4 million of matching federal revenues. The revenues from the assessment are primarily used to fund the Oregon Health Plan and to repay the hospitals as a group for the initial assessment they paid. The fiscal has been included in the governor's budget for the Oregon Health Authority.
Thank you. I have opened the public hearing. First, I'm going to ask if the agency would like to explain briefly some information about this bill. Mr. Colmer?
Thank you, Co-Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Sean Colmer, Governor's Office. I think LFO staff did a great job of outlining the bill. I think the only thing that I would add, and then be happy to answer any questions, is this is a product of almost 6 to 8 months of work with a broad stakeholder group, including the Oregon Health Leadership Council, CCOs, hospital association providers, et cetera, that helped us build what you've seen in the governor's budget to fully fund our Medicaid program to our federal waiver. This is a large component of how we want to fund our Medicaid program. The other two pieces that are important in the governor's budget that I just want to make sure that you have context about and that you think about as we work farther into session after this package goes through is $1.2 billion of state general fund and then also using $138 million of tobacco master settlement agreement money for the health plan. Those three pieces were the pieces that we all came together on and what is affectionately known as the Medicaid funding package that's included in the governor's budget. With that, I'll stop and answer any questions that members might have, but hopefully you pass the bill today and move it on to the full committee, and then we'll see it on the floors.
Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Colmer? Thank you. We have looked at the sign-up sheet for public hearing. There is no one signed up to testify in the public hearing. Is that correct? I don't see any hands going up from the audience.
You know, I think I don't know if everybody else on this committee has experienced the same thing that I've had with Mr. Campbell being here and then also with Sean at your front door. I think I'm pretty well advised of what's going on here. I get it.
So what I understand is you've heard enough already. Is that it?
I didn't say it like that.
This is a complex bill. It's necessary. If you really want to get on the weeds on it, we can spend a couple hours. Judy Moore Pearson kind of came to my office yesterday, and we walked through it again for a good hour. I'm not going to put you guys through all that. Bottom line is it's a good, well-thought-out bill. A lot of people have worked hard in this hospital association, the governor's office, the legislators, and it's well thought out. I picked through it as much as I could. I couldn't find anything wrong with this bill. I think we should be moving it forward today.
Thank you, Senator Bates. I, too, want to express my appreciation to all the parties for all the work that was put into this, not only recently, but even starting weeks and weeks ago. Appreciate the outcome and the effort. I'm closing the public hearing. I'm opening a work session now on House Bill 2395.
Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 2395 be passed forward to the full Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you. I was just going to note that I know that there has been a lot of talk about the use of Tobacco Master Settlement Agreement money toward this. I don't see any other way we have to do it, but I just want to say for the record that I hope that we continue to fund tobacco prevention efforts. So look forward to working with you all in the future on that. We're done.
Madam Chair, if I could offer.
Yes.
By using tobacco money settlement this way, you triple the amount of money in the program. CCOs then and the Oregon Health Plan can go forward with tobacco prevention programs. And instead of just using the tobacco settlement money, they triple the value of that money and have even bigger programs we have out there.
As long as we use it.
Some of it will be used that way.
Yeah.
Thank you. Representative Stark.
Madam Chair, thank you. A question specifically for you. You said that the lobby's been coming to you or stakeholders have been coming to you for about the last couple weeks. They've been coming to me for about 6 months now, so I'm curious, how can we cut my visits down to a couple weeks?
That's something we can cover in another work session.
Okay. I don't know.
Senator Winters.
Don't have a question, but just a comment. This is something that we've done since 2003. I still have some of the scars on my back for getting this passed through this building in 2003. It's probably one of the best leverage utilization of dollars that we've done in this building that has allowed us to expand services, and also I hope that federally that they continue to allow us to do this.
And the other 26 states.
And the other 26 states. So I hope we get a unanimous vote through this.
We were the first or one of the first states to do this. It was the good work of Senator Winters and then Representative Rob Patridge, myself and others. That got this done in 2003. I never envisioned it would grow to a program of this size, but it's absolutely necessary. We pass this, and it's a good program. I don't know if Gretchen Morley is still working for OHA. She actually was the brains behind it. I went to Gretchen. She just came back from Washington, D.C. in 2003. We sat down and worked it out, and I kind of lost track of her, but she did a great job on this. Most people don't remember who she was.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just want to state I, too, used to feel like Representative Kenny Geyer on that issue, but upon further study, and thank you to Dr. Bates for putting this out in this record today, that it is the leverage that it provides, and that's going to be more than what we would have gotten just using it straight away for that. So as long as they don't do any more dumb ads, you know. But I think that prevention is prevailing here, and that's exactly the direction we should be going. So,
okay.
Thank you. Any additional discussion? Any objections? Motion passes. We need a carrier.
I'll carry it.
Senator Bates will be the carrier. Write down my name, but we may substitute.
Okay.
And we're closing the work session on House Bill 2395. I'm opening a public hearing now, House Bill 5026, Department of Human Services. Ms. Byerly.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, as I noted yesterday, today the Department of Human Services Director is back before you to kind of summarize the discussion you've had so far regarding the agency's programs. And as a reminder, we will hear more from them in phase two of our budget discussions. But this kind of wrapped the first portion of the Department of Human Services discussion for you.
Thank you. Ms. Kelly Seal.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Senator Bates, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Erin Kelly Seal. I'm the director of the Department of Human Services, and I have good news today is the last day you will see me for a few weeks, at least at this table. I'm in the process now of scheduling follow-up meetings with each of you individually, because the first phase of this is really intended to be an overview of the what and the why and a review of where we've been the last years, and we're really now starting the hard work together of where we want to be and what investments are most important to make for the 2 years to come. And so I just want to thank the committee for your time and attention these last several weeks on our budget. I know that there's been a lot of information both communicated and also additional information that is required, and we look forward to providing that to you. What I tried to do with the wrap-up presentation today was create a little bit of a summary document for you all in one place, so that as we go into this next phase, you'll have handy, at least for the five program areas, a couple of things. Some of the major points of discussion that we've touched on together that seem to have been things that I imagine you may want more information about or that you want to go forward in more discussion with, and also the major budget drivers, looking at in each part of the program where are some of the biggest drivers of budget and what conversations do we need to have about some of the funding mechanisms and issues that are coming up around the budget itself. Just a reminder around the themes and themes that apply to the entirety of the conversation that we've been having. In 2013-15, you all approved and asked the department to implement a significant amount of change in each of the program areas, and we continue to be in the process of that implementation of review and analysis around what's happened and is happening as a result of that change. And part of what you heard from us in the last few weeks is that we'd like to be able to continue what we started in many of those program areas, so that we really can work with you on whether the results that we all think we're going to get are actually being achieved as a result of those transformative efforts. We spent quite a bit of time talking about the federal dynamics around our budget. 65%+ of our budget is funded by our federal partnership. And we've talked a lot about federal changes that have happened in the last couple of years in each program area that are driving some of the budget decisions and some of the policy decisions that are playing out in these programs. We've talked a lot about the need to prioritize and which outcomes matter most, and how it is that we think we're going about achieving those with you and what we may need to do differently. We've talked about a commitment to prevention, upstream investment, really trying to get ahead of some of the bigger cost drivers that end up being more responsive and more costly on the back end of the programs. We've talked about the importance of financial sustainability over the long term in the program areas, what the department needs to do more of in order to achieve that, what we perhaps need to do less of in order to achieve that. And we've talked about the fact that this work is not something that DHS does on its own, but in fact we leverage partnerships in the community at many, many levels to be able to accomplish this, and it's imperative that they're included and involved both in the decisions around what matters and also how to get that work done. This is just a high-level overview of the budget and what is going on between the 13-15 and the 15-17 budget. It is an increase in general fund that has been proposed by the governor for the DHS budget. We are using the governor's budget as a marker here, knowing full well that you all have a co-chair's budget that will drive us towards some different conversations as we go forward. But this, you can see, is sort of a high-level summary. Again, these are intended for you as reference points, and we'll just keep doing them by program area so that you can see where that increase is really coming from. You started the conversation with us in aging with people with disabilities and those program areas. You heard from Mike McCormick and Ashley Carson Cottingham about the policy and direction there. And these were some of the key issues that you all spent time on with them and that I anticipate we may need to spend more time on together. The aging demographic and demographic trends around people with disabilities and how those are impacting the costs and the caseloads in the programs. The implementation of the K plan and what that has meant in this program area for seniors and people with disabilities, and the difference between that impact in this program area and in the program area serving people with developmental disabilities. We talked about the United States Department of Labor regulations that are currently pending in the middle of a court challenge, but also are driving us toward some important policy conversations about that workforce and the quality of care they're able to provide to service to seniors and people with disabilities living in their own home and the compensation they receive for the hours that they work. We talked about changes that the federal partners, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, is asking departments to make around home and community-based services, something Oregon has done for a very long time. Rules and regulations, though, that will require some modification for us in planning. That's basically a five-year plan that we submitted and which has been approved by the federal government that we need to continue to work toward around some of those changes. And we've also given you some updates via report, and we have more updates to come around a significant level of change and multiple initiatives that you all approved and started as a result of the special purpose appropriation that are driving us into some new conversations about programming for seniors and people with disabilities, whether that's programming designed more to expand Oregon Project Independence to serve people with disabilities, to look at the connection to the healthcare system, to look at data and cost drivers, or quality of care in facilities. Lots of big issues summarized here, but that's just a high-level review of some of the bigger things I think we talked about, certainly not intending to reflect all the questions and answers that we submitted to you all in response to that couple of days of hearings. This is a picture of the APD budget. This budget represents 28% total of the Department of Human Services budget, and between the 13-15 and 15-17 budget, you can see that there's about a 13% increase in total funds here. These are the major budget drivers in the aging and people with disabilities budget. You can see where those dollars are coming from, where that percent increase is coming from. The vast majority of it is in caseload and cost per case. We also have investment around the nursing facility rates that is statutorily required. We have the costs associated with implementation of those Department of Labor rules hanging in the balance. The investment was actually made in the IDD budget, but the $28 million of that $35 million investment is actually in support of the programs under the Aging and People with Disabilities headings. You've had a conversation, and actually will have more conversation with us about the data system supporting the adult abuse and protection system. We have a workload model that applies both to us and to our Area Agency on Aging partners, and there's funding in the budget that supports that implementation. Because of the caseload and cost per case increases, the provider taxes are supporting more of the program, and that results in less need for general fund. So that same dynamic around the provider tax that you just discussed on the hospital side has a play in the DHS budget in the nursing facility provider tax. And then the governor's budget did assume a 3% vacancy factor savings across all program areas. So that's a high-level summary of some of the major budget dynamics here.
Madam Chair?
Yes, thank you very much. Ms. Kelly Seal, I'm talking about this 3% vacancy factor. Where are you now in DHS in terms of your vacancy factor?
Madam Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward, I'd love to get back to you on that. I have some documentation about it, but I don't want to get the number wrong on the record.
Thank you.
Can get that for you.
I appreciate it. Quick follow-up, Madam Chair. If you could just include some information about how you think that's going to affect your ability to do the work that we're asking you to do, that would be helpful to me as well.
Madam Co-Chair, Senator, thank you. We will do that.
Thank you very much.
Following the Aging and People with Disabilities program, you heard from the Intellectual and Developmental Disability Services program. Lilia Tennedy is our director, she presented a lot of information to you about those services, and these were some of the more major issues that came through that discussion. Again, the implementation of the Community First Choice or K-Plan option and its impact and how that differs from the impact on the system serving people, aging and people with disabilities. We talked about the plan of care system, also called Express, the upgrades to that system, the drivers behind those upgrades, and the impact that that's having in terms of workload for providers and community partners. And we know that will be an ongoing conversation as we continue to implement some system changes to reduce workload, but also think about the changes and the workload impacts that have already taken place. We talked about provider rates and wages for those who are serving people in 24/7 facilities, direct service providers, and what it looks like for them in terms of turnover as a result of wages. And you had a special report that you commissioned from a budget note on that topic, and we expect that conversation to continue with you all. The stabilization and crisis unit program, these are the 24/7 group homes that the state employees operate and serve consumers within. And as you know, we're having an active dialogue about client safety, staff safety, and the program design in that area, and what we need to be doing to bring that program into a model that's more reflective of the population that we're serving today. The Department of Labor regulations also impact this program area, so do the home and community-based services regulation changes. And we had a special presentation on Employment First as a policy, and that policy transcends both the IDD program, the Voc Rehab program, and the Department of Education as we're working on improving employment outcomes for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. This is a picture of the budget. These services represent about 21% total of the Department of Human Services budget, and this is where the vast majority of the budget increase in DHS is occurring. The governor's budget to accomplish the things that it includes a 20%, almost a 21% increase in services and funding for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. These are where those major cost drivers are coming from. And I will say that percentage increase is a little over-representative because of the Department of Labor issue and the fact that the $28 of the $35 belongs over in the APD budget. So you would see that percentage that I represented here go up just a bit when that allocation actually occurs, and this one go down just a bit. And I tried to highlight that for you here in that third bullet in terms of just where that ended up technically in the governor's budget and how that is represented and how we will need to work on that with you going forward. But there are significant caseload and cost per case investments in this budget. There is an investment around the continuation of the Employment First policy. And again, this is an investment that is actually mostly benefiting the Voc Rehab program, so it shows up in both places. There are investments around provider capacity for transition programs around the individuals that are currently being served in stabilization and crisis unit, but also some of the harder to place individuals that are in 24/7 residential settings that are serviced by community partners. There is a 4% rate increase for non-bargained services. And we know that you're having conversations with providers about how that translates or doesn't into a wage increase and what that really means. They are two different measures of increase, one around the issue of wages, as we talked about, and then one around the issue of rates. This is a rate increase, and we'll keep talking with you about what that looks like overall in terms of your policy objectives around wages. We did implement a workload model in this program area for the community developmental disability programs and the brokerages. We went out and did time studies with them to measure how much time the work actually takes. They will tell you that those workload models already need updating. We have we make every effort in the department to update workload models every 2 years going into a new budget process to make sure they're as current as possible. But it is always the case that when we do a workload study, new changes occur after the study happens, and the timing of work changes. But at the time that we conducted the study and we looked back at the caseload model that had been in place for these programs and services, this is our estimate of how out of alignment we've been in terms of financing for those programs and those partners. And so there's a very significant investment to get them to 95% equity and implement the workload model in the budget, in the governor's recommended budget. We know we need to have more discussion with you about Fairview Trust and the disinvestment that was that happened in the governor's budget around the Fairview Trust. And the conversation about what that trust needs to look like going forward into the future, given the K-Plan and the kinds of things that the K-Plan can purchase and service, and then also given the commitment statutorily that was made to the DD community when Fairview was closing. So that's an ongoing discussion we know we need to have. And again, there's the 3% vacancy factor that is considered in this budget as well.
Yes, Representative.
Hi, thank you. Could you go back to the SACU part and talk about what the increased investment would go toward?
So in the governor's budget, the focus was on, targeted in this particular policy package, was on the development, some incentive funds to create new capacity in community-based settings for individuals that are very hard to serve to be served by community providers. So to transition them from a state-operated program into a community-based, community-operated program. And we've been actively engaging with community programs about what it would require for them to do that. And so these are some startup grants around just creating better infrastructure and better capacity for them. When that happens, we're also going to need to work with them on rates for those individuals in those 24/7 settings. And we also know that we are having a conversation at the bargaining table with AFSCME about what investments or need to be made in the program that is currently being operated by the state. So those investments that are being contemplated at the bargaining table are not on this page.
Okay, thank you.
After we talked about developmental disabilities, we talked about vocational rehabilitative services with Trina Lee, our interim director, and the issues that we focused that came out of that conversation as perhaps needing some ongoing attention and focus are employment first. The fact that we do have a new federal law, the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, and its implication for that program, since it did take effect immediately upon passage and included some significant change for the program in terms of where the budget goes around youth services and how quickly things need to happen for people with disabilities in that program. We spent quite a bit of time talking about the budget and its mechanics, the basic 110 block grant, the maintenance of effort requirement, and then what that might mean in terms of an order of selection. We talked a little bit about the policy of an order and if the state had to actually implement the waitlisted order, what that would mean for consumers. And then we talked about the Centers for Independent Living, the outcomes they achieve, and the fact that right now we don't have statewide coverage, but that you all made an investment last biennium that did shore up the infrastructure of the existing centers, and that they've got a plan that they're working toward around that statewideness and what that really means for people. The voc rehab budget is only about 1% of the total DHS budget, and there's actually a decrease in total funds in the VR budget itself. In the next biennium, even though, and this is, again, this particular investment is actually sitting technically in the ODDS budget, the developmental disability budget, but it does have implication for the VR budget, and the 3% vacancy factor is currently contemplated in that VR budget, which is really the majority of the driver for the decrease.
Can I ask a question there?
Certainly.
So I'm just wondering how you could have more FTE and still have a lower overall budget. What else is it going towards aside from?
Sure. Co-chairs Nathanson, members of the committee, Representative Kenny Geyer. There is another package within the governor's budget that would take federal funds and create positions that would be able to serve clients in the VR community. Without adding any general fund to the program.
Okay, thank you.
And for the record, that was Eric Moore.
Oh, sorry.
Thank you. And when you say package, you're talking about a policy option package, so that would be an addition.
That's correct.
That will be considered.
That's correct.
Thank you.
After we talked about VR, we had a conversation about our self-sufficiency program area. The key issues we talked about there were the impact of the economic recession and now the movement toward recovery, even though and what that recovery is resulting in terms of its impact for consumers, for rural communities, for employment outcomes. We talked about the redesign and reinvestment. That's a big conversation happening both in the policy and the budget arena. We talked about employment-related daycare and the program expansion, as well as the policies that have been implemented in that area and its overlay with early learning and our goals around kindergarten readiness. We talked about the benefits cliff and some of the other policy conversations that are occurring in the building about really impacting positively people's financial stability and outcome and how different levers get pulled in order to do that and how the TANF redesign might be structured in order to accomplish less of a cliff for people who benefit from the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program
Erin, I'm going to interrupt now. On the topic of the benefits cliff is an issue not just for TANF, but for many programs, in my opinion. What are the plans to have a broader conversation about the problem of you either qualify or you don't, you either get 100% of a benefit or zero, as opposed to some sort of prorated benefit if you need a little bit of help or it needs to be decreased gradually, and that it involves multiple programs, not just one. When is the right time for a broader discussion?
Madam Chair, I appreciate that question very much, and I think this is a good time for that conversation. We're attempting in the TANF redesign to tackle that issue. I think when you overlay it with some of the discussions that are happening around the child care and the employment-related daycare program, that's also occurring. I think when I think about the other policy conversations that this body is having or has indicated that it may have around minimum wage, some of the revenue proposals that are working their way through the discussions, my hope is that we are having a broader conversation about where the investments make the most sense, what structures for programs make the most sense for people, and how we might have an opportunity this biennium to achieve that. I know that Mr. Moore attended a meeting that included, I believe, legislative fiscal as well as legislative revenue staff around how to create a model, perhaps, of so that as the legislative body considers investments and policy implications of those investments, that we can have a broader discussion about structure of programs, both in terms of onboarding and glide path off of program, and its relationship to all three of those areas, public benefits, tax and revenue policy, as well as wage policy issues that are taking place.
Thank you for that additional information and your response. I want to make sure that this doesn't get lost. What can happen in a session is that we're so focused on passing individual bills and looking at individual slices of a budget that we forget to take care of something important. This has been identified for many years. We've just never taken the time to address it. I hope it stays on our plate for this committee.
I agree.
But I hope that you continue your conversations as the executive branch and take some responsibility for bringing forward some proposals to us, how we can make changes that make sense to address concerns that we've all mentioned at different times in different hearings. It may be different bills or it may be different agencies that are affected. But there's a lot of interest in doing something. We've just never had a structured conversation and then a plan of action to do something about it across the board.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Cochran. Yeah,
since you started the conversation, I'll just throw my two bits worth in. We've talked about an omnibus poverty bill in the Senate. There's a lot of different parts to it, and unfortunately it comes from various parts of the legislature. The ones that are of importance here, however, seem to be the SNAP program, which is not a cliff. It's graduated out. I think ERDC, from what I can tell, is graduated out. TANF, I'm not sure. I think there's a cliff there. But we did a little modeling in our office, just kind of playing with numbers. The real cliff is Medicaid. You hit 133%, and you get dropped like a rock into a commercial product that's got a $5,000 deductible. And your premium won't be very high. And you've got co-pays and deductibles that really put you right back where you started from. So I just want to caution everybody that our preliminary look at this is Medicaid's the issue. You push that minimum wage up past the minimum, which is pretty doggone low, especially for a single person or one individual with one child, and you drop off that cliff at about $10,000, $11,000, $12,000, you know, income a year. So we have to be very careful with that. We'd like to see some more modeling from you guys, if you could. The other part of the modeling comes from agencies not associated with you. Earned income tax credits have to be considered, paid sick leave, all kinds of things that have come, like you said, from other areas. Somehow we're going to have to draw, if we're going to do anything in this session, we're going to have to draw those together in a package that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So I hope those conversations continue. We're doing it at our side, but not as much as we should yet. We've been a little busy this session. I think we'll look back at the first 3 or 4 weeks of this session and say, what the heck happened? And when the dust settled. But we still need to keep our eye on the prize. And from my point of view, that prize is poverty. Thank you.
Thank you.
Co-chairs, thank you. We really look forward to working with you on this, and I agree we have an opportunity here to look at it from a person's perspective as opposed to a program's perspective, and to really think about we may not be able to address every issue this session, but if we could create a plan of action where incrementally, session by session, we're working towards some change that would ultimately create better financial stability, more a policy of a safety net policy that makes more sense, particularly in light of the other policies that are at play here. We really want to be part of that conversation with you. So thank you for the opportunity. This budget, the self-sufficiency budget, represents 35% of the DHS budget, primarily in the SNAP program, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Those are non-limited federal funds, 100% federal funded benefit. You can see that's where the majority of the funding is invested, and the relative investment is less than 1% in this program area, as an overall increase from this biennium's budget. This is where the dynamics around this budget play out more specifically. There is a very significant investment in the governor's budget in the child care program and its expansion. There are, however, significant savings in this budget around caseload savings, which is something that is a good thing in the sense that the economy is recovering and fewer people are in need of service. There is a recommendation to reinvest some of that savings into program enhancement and design changes in the temporary assistance for needy families. And then there are some changes, again, to get things into alignment. The governor's budget was recommending that the food programs that currently sit in the Oregon Housing and Community Services Agency move to the Department of Human Services, and there is a slight expansion of investment in the Oregon Food Bank in this budget. We've talked with those partners over the last many months, Margaret Van Vliet, the director of the Housing and Community Services Agency, and myself, and based on my most recent understanding, they are absolutely okay with this move. This is predominantly the Oregon Food Bank. I went and met with the local food bank directors. We think there's big opportunity to first of all and foremost, not create any more bureaucracy around them and what they do, but also to leverage their programs and the policy around the issues of hunger and the root causes of hunger as we think about the SNAP program and what's going on there. This wouldn't mean that we have all the hunger programs. There are hunger programs sitting in the Department of Agriculture still, but it would create a little bit more alignment around these programs, and it's just an opportunity for more discussion with you about that. There's also an investment in 211 services in our budget to ensure the financial stability of that program and its statewideness. I think we've heard a lot about how that program is very beneficial and helpful in many communities already. We want to make sure that that is able to be leveraged into all communities.
I'm going to interrupt now.
I apologize.
On the topic of 211. In addition to the service that they provide to individuals, and secondarily, the service they're providing on behalf of state agencies and other organizations by doing really smart referrals and understanding who should get referred where. There's another potential use for 211. There are many times when committees like ours ask for information, or departments are going to present us with information on here's the state of the state with regard to, and you name some topic, whether it's child welfare or hunger or needing housing assistance or something else. Sometimes what we're looking at is information that's a year or two old because it's based on verified data from some source, whether it's census or survey or data tabulated from client lists in the prior fiscal year, but sometimes it is kind of dated information. When I have toured the 211 Center and see the volume of activity there and the data that they do have available just for their own purposes on how many phone calls are coming in, on what topics, and where they're getting referred, it seems to me that 211 itself could be of potentially tremendous value to state agencies in giving us a more real-time snapshot of what's happening now, or this month, or the past 2 or 3 months, for example. Sometimes you'll see these blips when there's a health scare in a certain region, for example, or there is a weather-related incident that causes temporary displacement and people needing assistance. But sometimes it's just seeing the more recent developments in as housing supply becomes too short in an area and the rental rates go up and people become homeless because of that, for example. They can't compete in the market for a place to live. I would hope that the state would be able to figure out a way to use 211 data on what it is people need help with and where they're getting help when you're providing information to us.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. We have worked hard to have a stronger relationship these last couple of years with 211, and we still have more work to do, so I appreciate your support for that.
Madam Chair,
yes.
I don't know. I mean, I think most of us are familiar with 211, but if you're not, I would strongly encourage you to learn more about what they do, because they do provide absolutely invaluable infrastructure. And I should also point out that the state works with 211 not only for human services support, but, for example, they staff the tsunami debris hotline, which is also an important service for our state as we continue to get in debris related to the earthquake in Japan a couple of years ago that's now made its way across the Pacific, and we want to avoid invasive species. So having a robust 211 infrastructure in this state is absolutely critical to help us with emergency preparedness and with ongoing day-to-day needs of Oregonians. So I'm really excited about this organization and excited to see the state partnering with it more and more.
That's just an aside, because I think it's important for people to know that it's not just human services that they help us with.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Just keeping us moving, child welfare programs that also were the last major program area to present, and the discussion in that program area focused on the statewide rollout of our enhanced practice model to include differential response, the expansion of the community contracted service array that was created by Senate Bill 964, the Strengthening, Preserving, and Reunifying Families Programs and Services, and the positive impact that that's having on outcomes. The Title IV-E waiver that we successfully negotiated this last biennium with our federal partner to ensure that as we safely reduce our foster care utilization rate, that we are able to keep any of the federal savings that we're achieving as a result of those efforts and reinvest them into services and programs that create safety and family stability for children. The federal law changes, recent federal law that has, for me, two major pieces that I think a lot about: the development of the sex trafficked youth program. There's active dialogue also going on in policy committee about creating alignment around that law with our laws. And also, there are some limitations on permanent foster care that bill creates that we're going to need to partner with the judicial branch and attorneys in order to be able to implement effectively for foster youth. There's a conversation that we're having with the Department of Justice. There was a budget note passed. As you all know, there's a law that requires child welfare staff to be represented in court that was temporarily suspended when we had conversation about the fact that current practice has allowed, especially when there are just updates occurring, allowed for child welfare workers to appear in court, not to practice law, but in order to just provide general updates to the court. We've been actively dialoguing with the Department of Justice on how to implement a full representation model and what that needs to look like. And then we have a federal review of our child welfare program coming in 2016, which will be a significant body of work for us and for our teams.
Yes, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Aaron, I am getting back to the one piece before. Let's see if I get back here. I just got to get back. Is that it?
Was it the self-sufficiency?
Yes. There we go. Okay. So, I mean, we've had this conversation before, along the line of public assistance programs. earlier this week, I heard some information which I thought was rather interesting. And I know I'm very supportive and interested in seeing us increase the FTE positions on the fraud investigative unit for that by 3 more positions. Actually, I wouldn't mind seeing it even a little bit more, be truthful with you, with what their caseload is. But I also heard at the same time when I asked this question of how many FTEs were assigned to the quality control unit, the QC, and I heard that there was 59. So I'm thinking to myself, having known what the QC is all about and they're in what their limitations are, but also what they do have for tools available compared to that of the folks from the fraud unit, I just thought, wow, 21 versus 59, this just didn't seem right to me for a balance. And I'm just kind of curious, where do we go with that?
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, I really appreciate the question. We are working on the follow-up from Monday's presentation just to make sure that big picture is presented to you. I believe the policy package that is in the governor's budget, which you haven't heard a lot of detail about yet because it's technically invested in what is called a shared service, and we're up in front of you in April around our shared services budgets, is actually far more than 3 positions that the governor was recommending be invested into the fraud and investigations unit to reduce caseloads and allow for more follow-up and follow through on the reports that we get. I will say that the quality control unit and the units that in general service these programs around accuracy and performance have a long history that we want to give you more information about. When the self-sufficiency programs also qualified people for Medicaid, the reviews that are mandatory currently that the federal government requires really center on the Medicaid and the SNAP program. And when you look at where the fraud referrals come from, they very most often come from our workers, both the frontline staff that have an instinct around what may be going on, and also from the reviewers who look at files and generate an impression of what's going on in a file review process. So it's all part of a continuum of program integrity, everything from the frontline staff that have a commitment to accuracy to the quality assurance and review process that goes back in and make sure that we're following policy when we qualify someone for a benefit, but also that if there's a concern, that they're then elevating that concern both from a system or on an individual basis, and then the fraud unit. I think we've recognized for a long time that as the caseload grew during the recession, it's certainly true that the ability to invest in certain parts of the organization was not as strong as some people and some of us would have liked. We were reducing budgets. We were reducing shared services budgets quite a bit. A lot. We really prioritized investments during the recession in the programs and in the frontline service deliverers. I think this is a biennium where we get a chance to really take that step back, look at the balance of service across the continuum, and see where are we out of balance and how do we reset in terms of where staffing investments need to be. And I think that's in large part why you see an investment in the fraud investigators in the governor's budget.
You know, Madam Chair, I would just follow up on that. I would be very interested in knowing more about what QC does.
Absolutely.
I mean, of those 2 investigative agencies that you have there involved in that, I mean, I get quite well what's going on with the fraud investigation for the connection with what's happening in the communities for law enforcement and program integrity. I mean, we've talked about this before, but I've got to get my hands wrapped around trying to figure out why there's so many, FTEs there with QC. So
absolutely. We welcome a chance for that conversation.
Okay. Thank you.
And before I call on Senator Winters, I'm going to follow up with a question. The slide that's in front of us is self-sufficiency. However, if quality control is in the program support services area, so it applies across the agency to different programs, where is, I assume there are some people who look at child welfare programs, for example, to see what percentage of the time procedures are followed or they're not because someone wasn't familiar with the rule, just couldn't get to it, whatever. So not only in self-sufficiency, but child welfare, when something happens when it's supposed to or doesn't happen. what kind of oversight is there?
Madam Chair, I really appreciate the question. It's been a major focus for the executive team. When the quality review process was originally created, it was housed entirely in self-sufficiency, and we moved it into the program support function so that we, because of a commitment to growing the programs that had that review function apply to them. We have not historically had quality control under that heading and in this unit for child welfare, but we are in the process of creating it because we have a commitment to it, and we think, you know, of all the many services that we provide, particularly around safety, the safety of children is one of our top priorities, and that program has had other ways of reviewing. I mean, I just recently, in preparation for the Child Abuse and Neglect Fatality National Commission that came to Oregon to speak to us, reread every CERT critical incident response team report that we've done as an organization since 2004. We've had other ways of getting at issues of quality and are people following policy. But in an attempt to standardize that effort, we decided that this unit should move out from a particular program and into a service to the entire agency, and we've been growing their capacity around other programs so that they can review. So when you get information from us, you're going to see how many reviewers are assigned to which program, how much capacity they have in each program to do those reviews, and we'd be happy to talk to you about how we've self-generated and really reinvested prioritized financing to make sure that we can get those reviews in place, because it is an important function for us. We want to make sure that we have objective people taking a look at the work that our frontline staff do and telling us whether those frontline staff are in compliance with our policies or out of compliance, and how we can course correct to make sure that we're doing everything we can to be in compliance.
As this unit is developing its capacity and its procedures to apply to various programs, are you in consultation with the Secretary of State's audit division, which is very skilled in not only financial audit, but program audit and program review? Has there been any collaboration to get ideas about best practices, for example, and how to go about this?
Madam Chair, I would say I would say yes, but I want to be clear about your question. I don't know that I've ever asked Gary Blackmer whether he thinks how to construct this unit and what they should do. But I would say that we have been actively dialoguing both within particular audits they've undertaken and also outside it. I've been fortunate that that Mr. Blackmer has spent a lot of time with me these last several months, sort of offering general observations and sort of systemic looks at our approach as an organization to audits, quality control, and quality assurance. We certainly can do more with them. We have an internal audits team as well. We have federal auditors, and we've been looking at the totality of that work, where the audits are happening, where our risks are, and how to measure that. You know, we're a large organization, and we do a lot of really important work. And these are really important parts of what we do to ensure that we're doing the best that we can. The last piece I would add, though, is we have been in consultation with national partners on this issue of quality assurance, because there are specialty areas of focus, say, in child welfare, where they have a particular way that nationally consortiums of experts are giving advice to states about how to do those quality reviews, and we've also been consulting with them.
Sounds like lots of connections are there. Thank you. Representative Stark.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And then Senator Winters.
Aaron, will you lay out, I've seen you in two different committees giving presentations and a lot of things, and we talked a lot about reunification. And on the topic of quality control, the other day with the systems analysis and all of our data stuff, there was a 12-month mark, and somebody asked where that number came from, and it sounded like the answer was kind of that it was arbitrary. Would you, for the committee and for the public that are watching, give us just a 60-second on the outline for when a child comes into care? What are some of the everything from, you know, their immediate, the parent has to have a hearing, that your 30-day mark, your 60-day mark, your 6-month CRB, your 12-month, you know, permanency hearing, your 18-month, you know, plan B. Would you just give us just a quick outline of what that process is so that we all understand that there is some thought and reasoning to some of these dates that we've heard about reunification?
And you know what, I'm going to
premature.
Interject for a moment here. This is a broad wrap-up conversation, and it sounds like there might even be some more specific information that would be useful. And I hope Ms. Kelly Seal has the response, but we could also wait for additional detail until we can get the program director
involved. The foster parents usually are given a bookmark that lay it out. Yes. It's a quick...
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Stark. I appreciate the question. There is a lot of intentionality and legal framework that surrounds the timelines that you hear us talking about in the child welfare program. I don't want to misstate any of them, and I will say that at one point in my career 3 years ago, I was much closer to them. Now I'm up here, and I'm afraid I would confuse things too much to give you the detail on them. But I will say that, you know, this is a program that is heavily regulated by our federal partner and by our judicial partners. And the timelines that are laid out are legal timelines that we are striving to meet, and also national markers about child welfare systems and what is expected of them. So they're not arbitrary deadlines in the least, and they're also driven by research and best practice so that we can make sure that kids' best interests are being served. What I'll do in response to your question, though, is provide for the committee that timeline that we do give to foster parents so they can anticipate, what will happen at what point in time, how often the courts may be involved. But I will also give the caveat that many courts have us in front of them more often. Many CRBs decide, citizen review board panels decide they'd like to hear or see a case more frequently than those timelines lay out. And so I would say that the timeline is the bare minimum for review and accountability, and that in addition to that, many other reviews often occur in order to make sure that cases are moving and that children's best interests are being served and that parents' rights are being honored in the process as well.
Thank you.
Senator Winters.
Just quickly, because we talked a little about the fraud unit and then the quality control unit, and there's another component. I'm going to ask if there's another component, and that's the training component. Because as quality control and others find problems, what do you do in order to remedy the problems that you've identified? And I've heard nothing about that particular piece. And just add on to that, because we talked about in terms of best practice. There's one timeline, and then the other one is case practice. So can you help us with that? Because I think it's more than just the quality control piece. Who provides the training, Aaron?
Co-chairs, Senator Winters, we have within our program areas people who specialize in training, who focus on both training proactively for new policy and its implementation, but also training that is remediation for concerns that arise. And so the training units look different in each program area. We're actually having an active conversation right now across training units in the department around things in common. And we're seeing more of an enterprise approach in discussion about training that needs to transcend program. But we do have a commitment to staff that if challenges are identified, there may need to be a one-on-one consultation with a staff person about a particular issue. More often, there are systemic issues that occur, and that we need to go back around with staff to help identify and remediate. And we do have units that are committed to that process.
So, Do you have a centralized unit anymore, or is it just based on?
Yeah. Co-Chair Senator Winters, when the department reorganization that occurred in 2001 was then undone, the units currently are within programs. So we do not currently have a centralized unit that focuses on program training. We do have a very small group of, I think it's 3 to 5 people in our HR department who look at workforce training, and they are a shared service between us and OHA. So that's for 10,000 people. But we have program units of training, and we've been doing an inventory of that of late and actually engaging in a discussion about what the right model is for training for our department. We kept the training close to programs when the department split from the Oregon Health Authority, because the programs had a concern about the proximity of trainers and their expertise and their ability to specialize in particular program areas and policy areas. During the recession, training budgets were depleted. needed. It was not, I mean, it, and it's more than the recession. If you think back to this agency's experience since 2001, the infrastructure as a whole of the organization has been reduced and reduced and reduced as the priority has been really placed on programs and services, rightly so, for Oregonians. So we're really at a process right now as an organization and have been going through it for the last several years since 2011. Of really evaluation and reconstruction, and doing that within limited resources and staying within budgets, and starting from a place, quite frankly, that I think is far short of what ultimately we would have done or would need in order to meet the true need around some of these areas.
Follow-up, then, given all of the changes that have occurred in child welfare, given all of the federal mandates that come down, given all of the impacts that come from the community, I'm just trying to see how you juggle those training needs, because they become, actually can be that piece of your process that actually helps to prevent problems that occur. And I'm sitting here trying to figure out, you know, what's the discussion inside of the agency as sure. It relates to.
Co-Chair Senator Winters, in child welfare, and actually there is a policy package. Let me go to that slide. This investment, the $2.2 million general fund. In child welfare, there is a model in that program area that has created teams of people that provide consultation to the field. We have training that is supported by Portland State University when we onboard child welfare staff. We continue to work with Portland State both across child welfare and self-sufficiency programs around larger training areas like the Oregon Safety Model Refresh that rolled out and the development of that curriculum. And then we roll it out to our staff. And we also have a consultation model wherein we have staff that are dedicated and specialists in certain areas that go out to the field and work with them on practice improvement and practice enhancement. In this budget, you'll see investment in some infrastructure in the child welfare program around the very issue, Senator, that you're raising. Because we have so many federal changes, because of the changes in practice, because we have a goal of implementing differential response by the end of the biennium and not having it take longer than that, and because we've learned as we've rolled it out in the first three counties that it takes time both to learn the new model and then to have someone walking alongside you as you implement so you don't create undue risk or unsafe situations for kids, and you really are creating behavior change in the child welfare workforce. Differential response is not just a technical change. You don't change the law and have differential response. It's an actual change in philosophy of practice. And so we've made a recommendation to you that you make some investment in that this next biennium because it's so important, and we think we have an opportunity to strengthen the teams that are responsible for making that happen.
I hope that you give some serious conversation, because you are talking about changing casework practices when we start talking about differential response. And you're also talking about having an ongoing actual training activity, because it's not just one day that you have training. It can be several iterations. So I hope that this conversation, and I don't know if you've done a cost analysis or not on that linkages between Portland State and others through contracting services, or whether you had it all in-house. Just some thoughts.
Thank you. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to follow up a little bit on what Representative Olson brought up. And back in the day, when 2005, when I was on this committee, they were just, I think, just starting to introduce the performance measures. And I'm just wondering how that has morphed into this, assuming they've got some new requirements, et cetera. And, it, you know, because it sounded like, and maybe I missed something, but it sounded like there aren't, at least for child welfare, that there aren't these same oversights that there are in some of the other sectors of your purview. And, for example, the other self-sufficiency stuff. And I would think that the children's, their child welfare would rise to the top. In a sense. And so I wondered how those, you still use the performance measures in the same way, how they relate to what you're doing mm-hmm. now.
Co-Chair, Representative Boone, let me clarify something for you. So So you're talking, I think we're mixing apples and apples a little bit. So the issue of apples and oranges. Thank you. Well, I was thinking about Granny Smith and Honeycrisp, all right? So the function of a quality control and review happening at the state level is different than a commitment to performance measures and review of outcomes. They're two different things. The child welfare program has had for a long time federal performance measures that it's held accountable to. The state, of course, has had the progress board and the benchmarks and the key performance measures. And within DHS now, what we are trying to do, we have quarterly business reviews. We have one coming up next week. And we take performance measures at both the DHS-wide enterprise level, and then our programs do individual reviews. And our frontline staff actually participate in this through the Lean Daily Management System. And so all of these, what we're working on right now, as this commitment toward outcomes has gotten to be such part of our practice and our breathing every day, so we're working on that line of sight from the front line and what they care about every day in terms of just having face-to-face contact on time within their 30-day period and getting their business process, their investigations done on time, seeing foster parents in a timely way, completing certifications timely, et cetera. Those measures all the way up to the enterprise measure at our review. And then we're trying to take that and align it to those key performance measures that you're hearing about. So hopefully you're holding us accountable to the same things we're using to hold ourselves accountable to manage. We've given up a little bit on perfectly aligning with our federal partners. We have some alignment that I think is important and possible. And then other pieces, quite frankly, where, you know, in not just in child welfare, but in parts of our programs, we will keep measuring for them everything they require us to measure. But in our estimation, sometimes it's out of touch with what really matters in order to keep kids safe, achieve well-being, and permanency. So we hold that up here. The federal government does regular reviews. I mentioned that we have one coming in child welfare. I'm not going to remember the acronym, CFSR, but just suffice it to say it's a child federal review, something like that. They're coming. They do these regular reviews, and then they look at our outcomes, and we submit data reports to them on a regular basis. What the federal government has never required for child welfare programs at the states, though, is a quality control and quality assurance program. They've never required that. They are having those conversations right now. They have, on their public assistance programs, required quality control and quality assurance. And you know, those reviews are serious. They're required at certain intervals, and they've been part of the program infrastructure for many, many years around those public assistance programs. So what DHS has done around child welfare is said, we don't care if it's federally required or not. We want to create infrastructure for ourselves around these reviews for child welfare, because we looked across the agency and said, it doesn't make sense to have these on programs that are just about money. We need to have it for programs that are about safety. The money matters. Obviously, we have a strong commitment to program integrity and assurance and accuracy, et cetera, but it's also just as important that we're looking, that we have objective reviews on the kids' side. So we have parallel processes. We have the performance measures that are part of an overarching review of how are we doing, trends, how do we course correct, and then we also have these reviews that are happening on a case-by-case level, at a more micro level, to say our individual cases, is individual work happening in the way we want. And we use them together to really evaluate our effectiveness, our efficiency, and our need for remediation.
Quick follow-up.
Yes.
I just want to thank you, Erin. And you've addressed my concerns and answered several other follow-up questions. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Senator Sanger Hayward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Kelly, so I want to circle back to what Senator Winters was talking about a little bit about the training and avoidance of problems. And I think, you know, you and others participated in this Streamlining Delivery of Services Task Force that we held over the past year and a half after the 2013 session. And one thing that came up time and again was the quantity of what I refer to as the government equivalent of urban myth, which is that I can't tell you this because, and it turns out that there is no actual substantive reason for the because. Well, it's a policy. Can't find the policy. It's a rule. Can't find the rule. Well, my supervisor told me. Okay. Well, her supervisor told her, right? So my concern is that not only is the lack of training preventing people from making mistakes that actually result in adverse outcomes, which I know you're working very hard to prevent, but also that it's serving as essentially sand in the gears, right? I mean, it's just clogging the system up so much because people feel a little bit paralyzed about what they can and can't do, and it creates layers that can't, you know, that just really keep our workers from doing. And I guess I really have a two-part question as a result. The first is there any way of articulating what the lack of training might be doing in terms of adding paperwork time, bureaucratic time, rather than face-to-face case management time, for example, for child welfare or other self-sufficiency folks? And the second part of the question is, you know, if you think about this daily lean process stuff, my experience suggests, having a similar process in the medical setting, that sometimes there are unstated assumptions, and people don't even think to bring it up as an issue because they just assume that, like, I'm having trouble because I can't tell this person this piece of information, to use a simple example, and they never actually bring that up because they just assume there's nothing, that it is policy and there's nothing you can do about it. So I don't know what the atmosphere is of those settings and whether the people are encouraged to bring forth what they see as barriers to providing the level of service that they want to provide and we want them to provide. Sorry for the two-part question.
Co-Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward. So I want to answer your questions, but I also hope you'll indulge me for just a minute, because what you're really talking about is changing the culture of an organization. And it's been something that I've been working on at DHS since 2008. And I do think we have evidence that it is changing. But I think, obviously, we have a lot of room for improvement always as an organization. We use the Lean Daily Management System as a vehicle to really create opportunity for staff who do the work to tell us where the problems are, where their frustrations are. And alongside that, we have been emphasizing continuously, and I was reminded just yesterday that it cannot be overemphasized, an expectation that you will not get in trouble when you surface issues or problems, that we want to create a culture of trust and safety and authentic dialogue about how we improve as an organization, and that the staff doing the work have the best instincts for us, for me, about how to make improvements, and they also have the best ideas about what the improvements could look like. Issue by issue, we take on, sometimes one at a time, sometimes all at once. You heard a little bit about the continuous improvement unit, and I know we have follow-up work to do with you there as well. But, you know, that is a unit of approximately 25 or fewer people that are servicing 7,500 staff to implement and maintain and create alive this culture with me of authentic conversation for change and improvement. And they help map business process, improve business process, get rid of barriers that are myths, and create streamlined and more efficient ways of working for staff. At the hearing on Senate Bill 670 yesterday, one of our staff testified about the conversation that has occurred because of this issue of information sharing becoming a real concern for staff. Now we have more, we just issued a new policy and trained to it around what information can be shared. It's really about how to ask the right question. It's not, obviously we have a firm commitment to protecting privacy, but this is an organization that's trying to ask, how do we get better coordinated services, how do we better coordinate the information that we can share? That's a very different question than how do I protect you from the risk of sharing information that you can't. I will say that one of the culture challenges for the agency is risk aversion. We get in trouble when we fail, very publicly. And it's something that I'm working against all the time inside the agency, and it's something that we'll have to keep working on as an organization. Can we quantify how much training or how much more training would get at some of the sand in the wheels, if you will? I'm not sure that I can right now, but I can quantify for you, and we'll bring back some information, some of the improvement efforts that have been staff-driven that have resulted from their ideas of how to prioritize work, that prioritization of what to improve first doesn't happen at my level. It happens with staff who are vetting hundreds of CI sheets, which tells me that people feel free to submit them, that we have hundreds of continuous improvement sheets that they go through and they decide which of these are really change at the work unit level, which of these are change that really should happen statewide, and then how do we roll that change out collectively in small, medium, and large offices? How do we baseline to make sure we know what we started with, and then how do we measure whether we accomplished an improvement? And these committees, these governance groups, actually decide which of those are going to go first and how to implement them, and then how to achieve the accomplishment on the other side. And I'm proud that we've instituted that. I think it's getting results. Is it happening overnight? It is not.
I'm very proud about. I'm sorry. Go ahead. We have two more questions, and I'd like to adjourn at 5 minutes till 10. So do you want to give a brief follow-up?
It's a really quick statement. I just want to thank Ms. Kelly Seal, because it would be very easy as an agency director to take what we were doing with that 450 task force and say, well, we'll wait and see if any bills pass. But instead, you've made the commitment as an agency director to take that work and start implementing some of it right away. And that's exactly what we need from our agency directors. And I know it's not easy, and we don't expect overnight results, but I think it's emblematic of your overall ethos as a director, and I'm grateful. So thank you very much.
Representative Boone, did you want to add?
I will add it again. Yes. Thank you for all you're doing and for the performance measures.
Did you want to?
I just did.
But you didn't have an additional follow-up.
No. All okay. I wanted to do was to let her know that
that's fine.
She answered my questions and then some.
Okay.
Thank you.
Senator Bates.
We'll try to get you out of here fast. It's got a quick question for you. Considering, first off, I appreciate the work you've done. Everybody does. We're up here at 30,000 feet. I'm more worried about the caseworkers and the kids, and we haven't focused on the day. We used to have a huge turnover of caseworkers because this is awfully hard work. Not personally dangerous. It burns you out emotionally. 2-3 years and people can't take any more of watching these families and trying to help them. So my question to you is, we've reduced their caseload a little bit. I think we've done that successfully. We put up more work on them and asked for a cultural change at the same time. When you get a chance, I like to see what that caseload turnover is. That's a real marker that would be important to me. If more people are staying in there as caseworkers and less of them are just giving up because they're so burned out emotionally, that means we're moving, at least that part, we're moving in the right direction. So you're going to have to answer me right now. Bring that back in. Let's see what that trend looks like over the last 3 or 4 years.
Co-Chair Bates, I won't give you the specifics, but I will tell you that the turnover rate is declining. It's getting better, in other words. And it's because of the investments that you all made in staff. It's because staffing for that body of work. It's because of the business process improvement that's creating more time for staff to do the important work that they do, that they need, that they should own, because they created those ideas and implemented them. And so you see the workload level, the difference between the workload model and where we need to be and where we are shrinking, and we're seeing the turnover rate go down as well, which then results in more consistency, more stability. It takes about a year for a child welfare worker to even be able to do the work. And so we've onboarded new staff. They're learning. I had a conversation with Representative Stark recently about his experience with caseworkers. And we do have a model where you do get new caseworkers at different points in time in a case. And, you know, should we get to a point down the road when we want to tackle that issue and have that conversation after we fully implement a differential response, I think we're more than willing to have that discussion. But there have been significant improvements in staff turnover in the last several years because of things you all have done in support of that system. So thank you for that.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you. I don't expect responses. We're right at the end, but just the things on my radar that I'd love to hear about at some point over the next few months. One is, you know, why you have different workload target models for one area than another. That may have to do with your turnover rate, so I'd be curious more about that. Another is in the child welfare. It's great that we're putting more money into staff. I think the I know how hard it is for you to find families, so there's been a lot of discussion about why aren't we raising the rates there. So when we get back to the budget section for that, I'd love to hear more about that. And then I'm just curious about self-insurance. I know you had a big lawsuit where you lost, and it was $4 million, and that's out of these programs, presumably, since you are self-insured. So at some point, would love to know more how that plays into your budget process.
Thank you.
Great. And it, could you include at least some brief responses to a few of those points when you provide written responses? And then we'll figure out where in phase two we might have a bit more discussion.
Yes.
Madam Chair.
One last
question.
Yeah.
We've had the conversation of your legal cost. And so it would help if you, when you come back, talk about that cost, not only the risk side, but actually the trend lines that says how much that legal cost is going up. Mm-hmm. Are there some ways that we can actually do, what can we do to lower those costs? In addition to the, and that's why I'm on this training and some of these other pieces, looking at being proactive. Prospective on some of this, but we've talked about some of those issues, you and I, and you might want to bring those forward.
Thank you, Senator Winters.
And thank all of you. We really appreciate the time and attention to our budget, and we look forward to the work ahead.
Thank you for that closing. I really appreciate the way you prepared this wrap-up conversation for us, pointing out what we had talked about, the highlights, and what seemed important, and what else we need to discuss. It was a really good way to organize it. It was helpful to us, and I hope it's helpful to you as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee.
Anything else? We're adjourned.